Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Alexander Nemiroff. He is the Carl and Marilyn Thoma Provostial Professor in the Arts and Humanities at Stanford University. And we're talking about his new book, The Forest, A Fable of America in the 1830s. Alex, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here.
First of all, even the structure and the tone of this book is not like many other books I've ever read at all. It's fiction, although the characters are real. And I, from my mind, reading through it, I really had problems with fact and fiction throughout the book because I knew so many of the people that are in this book. I'm not personally, obviously, this place isn't. And it's interesting the way it's in nine parts, and each of the parts is made up of short chapters, which, to my mind, each one stands alone. You could read any one of those sections, and it would be a standalone piece that would be wonderful.
Thank you. Yes, I think you're right. I believe there are 59 total episodes or vignettes, as I call them, because they're all so short, and I really had in mind, I was picturing someone who could read one a night, for example, or one a day.
That's not going to happen, man. These are too addictive.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and each one starts anew, and they really don't refer to one another, except that they do under the broad auspices of the forest in the 1830s, all somehow, whether literally or figuratively, relate to that moment when the last of the vast forests are beginning to disappear, but haven't disappeared, and that becomes a central element in the consciousness, I suppose, not only of the characters who you mention are real, but in fictions, that is, inventions told by me, though not all of them are even real. Some are just imagined out of whole cloth by me. And, you know, I think it's in the consciousness of me, the writer, too, that forest that was and is not there now. And the relation between, I get ahead of myself, Mark, but, you know, the relation between trees and brains and
that's the Nathaniel Hawthorne
mystery of thoughts.
As you write in the book, Nathaniel Hawthorne saw trees as secrets or brains. And this brings up the whole 1830s in America, because it is a strange time that we don't talk a lot, but critical things are happening in America. Why did you choose that time?
I think in a way for the very reason you just mentioned I really chose it intuitively. And then I came, as so often, with my thought to understand why I had selected what I did, you know, later on. But I think partly it's to do with, it's the first moment where, you know, in the so-called market revolution, where trees are really sized up as a vastly exploitable commodity. But it hasn't really totally happened fully at that time either. And the conservationists, though I wouldn't really use that word, but the, let's just call them the artists and visionaries and romantics, still have a kind of superstitious, intense regard and relation with trees that hasn't been, as it were, fumigated out of existence. If I were to have selected the 1840s, I think that whole process would have been much more underway, and that decade consequently was less appealing to me, to say nothing of the 50s and onward. But I think that naturally you have so many key figures that most any reader would know: Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, Nat Turner, Jackson, Harriet Tubman, Sequoia, different figures like that. So that was attractive to me too.
It's fascinating how the forest figures into each one of these stories, because it's more than a backdrop. It seems like it was there, at least for the characters in your book, as part of the way they imagined America. There was this idea of America as this vast, untamed forest. And there's some amazing descriptions of it as a place that was so silent that it would drive you mad. As you mentioned, people are starting to look at it as either a commodity or some kind of weird mythic chonic, you know, residence of Pan. I mean, there's a character in your book who swears that he found Pan's cave. And so there's that kind of mythicness about looking at the forest, and then the plain old, now let's cut them down, we can make some money. And then that also contributes to the expansion west. And then there are the Native Americans who are living there, who are part of that whole situation too. And the artists, you know, when I think about him, I think about people like Thomas Cole, who figures into your book. And that fabulous painting of the tornado in an American forest. Again, it's that mythologizing of the American forest, and it figures in so many ways in this book. It's fascinating. And yeah. Like your book, the forest is so big and it's so complicated, you can't really make sense of it all. Like you write in your book, I think, that the reader searching for conclusive meanings will be disappointed reading the book.
Yes, don't you think that's right, Mark? Yeah.
I just felt like maybe it was all too complicated that I couldn't put it together.
Oh,
but come on, we are creatures that search for order, and so reading it creates a weird experience where you start like making little notes in the margins, like relating A to B to C to D, and you're right, it doesn't get you anywhere.
I suppose it's the feeling of being a little bit lost, but in a kind of supernatural way or unusual way, let's just say. And that, if I don't know if you'll agree, but for me as a writer, that is what I wanted to give in the sense of generosity to the reader. I wanted the reader, for once, not to be identified as a target audience to whom I could promulgate certain claims and arguments and more or less grab them by the lapels and tell them what they should believe, which, let's face it, is the basic tenor of our discourse, and instead kind of create an opening, let's say, or space for something not quite describable to happen.
Yeah, it's very ineffable. It really is.
Right, and that finally has to do even less with the forest or the 1830s and more with us, with people, with a kind of visionary experience, which, whether we call ourselves artists or poets or just, we are simply people walking our dog down the street, like, we all understand that there is some aspect to the world, which Emerson said, you know, is not explicable by rational calculations alone. And that was important for me as a writer to find and really explore. And I would say value in myself as much as it is a gift, again, I would like to give to the reader.
Have you ever been lost in a forest?
Fortunately, no. So you might say,
I have.
You have. What was the experience?
It's a lot like reading this book. Because you can see a tree, you see things that you know, but then it's all sort of evaporates. It's like the uncertainty principle along the periphery of your vision. And there's a sense of panic and wonder that, you know, in this day and age, you could get. I was lost in the forests of Australia, which is totally discombobulating. But that's I related that to this book, is that sense of there's an awful lot of stuff that I'm looking at, but I can't relate it to each other easily. Although I think there's a lot of things that are relating in this book, but it's almost like I don't want to talk about it because there's that Buddhist saying that as soon as you describe something, you lose it.
I think we could talk about it, but I think, though I appreciate your nicety about it, I think that I hear what you're saying, that, you know, the reader looking for a kind of progression of story and so on will not find it. That, in fact, like we were saying before, there are many stories. Each one is autonomous, but they together make a whole somewhat in the way that, like the threads of a tapestry, though extricable from the totality of the object, yet all make a common surface, you know? And so by that logic, I would assume that if I were to just open the book to any page at random and look at a sentence, I would feel or should feel that the DNA of the whole book is findable in that sense.
Yeah.
And I would think that for the reader too, though they may not, you know, be able to specify it so acutely, they would have the general sense that this is not random, that this is
a kind of
coherent, turn and return to a set of preoccupations, which yet remain open and not clenched down and argued about.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Alexander Nemiroff. He is the Carl and Marilyn Thoma Provostial Professor in the Arts and Humanities at Stanford University, and we're talking about his new book, The Forest, A Fable of America in the 1830s. Alex, there are so many sections I thought we could just take off and do an entire show about, but I just want to touch on a couple. The Davy Crockett Almanacs and the conception of masculinity in the 1830s. Can you talk about that? Because that was really interesting. And that actually cropped up in a couple of chapters.
Yes, it cropped up, as I recall, in the chapter called Ere You Drive Me to Madness, which is the murder of a prostitute in Manhattan in 1836, and her psychopathic boyfriend who killed her but who was acquitted was his kind of masculinity, a young clerk in the sort of piratical bachelor's Manhattan of the 1830s sort of fit the bill of the Davy Crockett Almanacs, which, for those of you who don't know, were, basically like very racy, very sexualized, very racialized accounts of the frontier exploits of the title character, and were read avidly by the young men who were their target audiences in the 1830s and 40s and early 50s.
Have a description in the book of male sexuality was violent, non-reproductive, usually non-genital, and frequently homosexual.
Yeah, I believe those are not even my words. I think I'm quoting from Carol Smith Rosenberg there, a great historian, but yes. And then the Crockett Almanacs appear in another chapter, which I made up entirely, really, just using some facts, which is one of my favorites, and which actually is one that Annie Prue, the great novelist, singled out as one of her favorites, which was very pleasing to me. It's called Moose and Stencil. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, it's kind of hard to describe. It's about a little girl making stencil drawings in her room as simultaneously a moose appears and mysteriously disappears in the woods. But in the context of that, I have her look at her brother's Crockett Almanac and have her meditate on the kind of illustrations in it, which are warlike, extremely violent in a kind of very crude way.
Right, very basic, like lines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was a fun passage to write when she's looking at those things.
Now, I have to ask you then, how did you write this book? Did you write it just one section and then, sort of file it away, and then you had all these sections and then you assembled them?
I gave lectures on the forest at the National Gallery in 2017. So it was the Mellon Lectures. There were six lectures. And the first set was called Herodotus in the Trees. And
okay,
the
yeah.
Second one was called Tales or Tavern to the Traveler. So there was some structure there, but the lectures are to the book kind of like just a brief sketch is to a painting, and the book is much more developed, has many more sections, many more episodes, and indeed the episodic structure is a coinage of the book. So I wrote it during COVID for the most part.
Yep.
And that was pleasurable, you know. And I wrote it, to answer your question, kind of one story at a time, more or less in order, but also then returning to it after a first draft was completed and adding new ones and taking trips here and there to kind of explore things further. For example, when we mentioned the one about the murder of the prostitute Helen Jewett, I went, and it was really a very beautiful experience. I went to the tiny town, not really even a town, just let's call it a place in far western Maine where she grew up, called Temple, Maine, and that was very beautiful. And not for the only time did I find in writing this book that American places like that are kind of Rembrandt-like in the sense that they are this country's great works of art in a way for the consciousness that knows or is fortunate enough to know how to appreciate them or see them. And, you know, it's to say nothing against Thomas Cole and the other painters, other artists, but, you know, sometimes the American places are the works of art.
Now, could I ask you to read a small section?
Sure.
Because I think it's important to give the listeners a sense of what we're talking about. Your choice, Mark.
Yeah, well, I know you had been interested in something about in this vignette called The Drug of Distance.
Yeah.
Which is about two brothers, one of whom dies of a drug overdose, and another becomes a very successful painter of landscape.
Because he's mastered the
story.
He's mastered representing distance.
Distance, right, exactly. So what I was interested in is how this painter, Sanford Gifford, great member of the Hudson River School and my favorite among those artists, really was a kind of deluxe, mesmerizing portrayer of distance, and how he kind of found this way of portraying the diaphanous, atmospheric blue mountains far away, et cetera, as just at the moment when his beloved brother was, who was a very troubled soul, died of a drug overdose. So I'm looking at here a passage from that chapter, call it a kind of religion. If not the open faith Gifford's mother wished for her children to profess, then if some silent devotion manifest in art, and, you know, his was the feeling of a sustained vision, a fasting saint staring at a mountain so long it starts to float, so long the mountain's name drops away, so long that the proximate world flees and everything starts sweeping backward in some reverse cosmology of light retracting and channeling, the sun setting, the clouds tinting like the blazons of an empire without a territory, no land at all. And I know you had been interested in another one too, in Painter and Oak, yeah.
Yeah, it was about his looking at the forest and just sort of his vision that he was having at the time as he looked up Well, wait a minute. I get so much more I have to talk to you about.
Okay. Well, yeah, sure. But I love that you asked me, Mark, because what I do think, I've spoken about this book a number of times now, and I think it's very fair and maybe understandable with a book called The Forest that people say, start asking me, you know, about eco-criticism and the Anthropocene and all stuff. And I think it's important for me to read just a few sentences like that, because you can see, I hope, or hear that it's really a poetic book. It's again, like we were talking about, trying to find a space where we can stop pleading and shaking one another, pleading with, shaking one another, and asking one to do something, be something, and just kind of be present in language and in the world.
There is just like an enormous collection of scenes or ideas that are in this book that just really captured my imagination. And one of them were the peddlers of clocks.
Oh, yes.
That idea just struck me as like these peddlers, like traveling across the country through all sorts of wild areas down, you know, poor dirt roads, selling clocks, just struck me as so odd. The first question I started thinking about, how do you set your clock when you're the only person around? And why do you need a clock? It's like, because if you're out there on the edge of forever there, it doesn't seem like clocks are so important. But that image of it's so rich of these peddlers of clocks tromping across the country. Wow.
Yeah, so time becomes an industry then that's actually related to the forests and the destruction of the forests. One of the great clock-making states was Connecticut, and one of the places where clocks were made was this town called Forestville, which was named Forestville after the forest that was destroyed to make the factories to make the clocks. So then from those factories you have, the emissaries who spread out far and wide to sell people then as now things that, as you're saying, they don't need.
But it's a sign of civilization. It's like a totem, a totem
it's
of
the next new thing. Yeah,
it's order.
Got to have a clock.
It's order as opposed to the forest.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah.
And then in under Samuel Morse in his Gallery of the Louvre, which people are enjoying by the light of argent lamps.
Yes,
that's a magical scene.
Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, I went to that place, Hyde Hall. I hope, Mark, you'll get a chance to go. It's really extraordinary place on the banks of the lake there in Cooperstown or just outside Cooperstown. I wanted to have, I pictured a winter night. And guests arriving and the place is lit up with this clean burning illumination. These are given by these argan lamps, and even the walls of the interior are mixed with a kind of mica to create more of a flourish and an illumination, a sparkle. And yes, a very famous painting made by the future inventor of the telegraph, Samuel Morse, hung in that space in that very house called, you're talking about it, the Gallery of the Louvre, which is basically a large 6 by 9 foot painting showing in miniature many of the greatest hits of the Louvre. So the Mona Lisa.
And that's the weird part about it. I mean, here's a painting of a ton of paintings being enjoyed by people by argent lamps. And what a meta phenomenon that is. It's like,
I know. I think, I mean, for me, sort of romantic that I am, I'm more interested in the tracks that the sleigh that delivered the guests make on the snow outside, and the way the moon might illuminate those tracks. To me, that is like a greater painting than the Gallery of the Louvre. But I digress. I think your point is really good, because who hasn't gone to a museum? I include myself in this and felt that the painting we're staring at is kind of denatured by that necessary display there in a hall of culture, and that what one really wants to know is, you know, to sort of recover the clink of the glasses of Madeira and you know, the taste of the pigeon pies or whatever it is that accompanied people as they sat down to dinner in the vicinity of this picture in some long ago place that, you know, was freezing cold outside but beautifully illuminated within.
Did you travel to a number of these places?
I did, yeah, when I could. It's, you know, there are some scenes that in Texas and one even in Hawaii, but it's really a book about the Northeast and the Midwest and the Southeast, I would say.
Right.
And, yeah, so I live in California, but I'm from Missouri, and I went to school in the East, so I really feel very at home traveling to these kind of locations, yeah.
Did you get to go to the Great Dismal Swamp?
I did not go to the Great Dismal Swamp.
It's there, and I want to go there, too.
Yes, I think that might have been my Australia, you know, in the sense that I might have gotten terribly lost there, but some I had to invoke, and, you know, always relying on someone like my hero, Emily Dickinson, yeah, who didn't really need to go much beyond Amherst to portray, I don't know, what would you say, the whole world.
Yeah, she didn't need to go beyond her house.
Right, and there's some of Thoreau in that, too, the sense that your own backyard is all you really need.
We're completely out of time.
And my backyard would be my head, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. My guest tonight has been writer Alexander Nemiroff. He is the Carl and Marilyn Toma Provostial Professor in the Arts and Humanities at Stanford University. And we're talking about his new book, one of the most fascinating, enjoyable, and sort of books that you experience, The Forest, A Fable of America in the 1830s. Alex, it's been a real pleasure.
Mark, thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.